Ritzy, how are you?
Good. How are you, Carmine?
Excellent. So what's going on?
I'm feeling really privileged today. Huh? So we are here with our special guest, Maria Clave, and she is a member of the board of Microsoft.
Member of the board?
Boy, isn't that amazing? So, you know, I can hardly believe it.
What does that mean?
What does it mean? Microsoft has a board of 10 directors. Two are Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer. And then there are 8 independent directors, and I am one of those people. The board meets 4 times face-to-face each year and probably another 4 or 5 times by conference call. Mm-hmm. And it's responsible for primarily 3 things, the long-term strategy of the company, the basically monitoring the performance of the CEO, mm-hmm. Steve Ballmer. And the third thing is making sure that the company is doing everything appropriately with respect to finance and legal issues and all those mm-hmm. kinds of things. So it's and obviously the board represents the interests of the shareholders right. in terms of trying to take care of the company.
So we are talking to Steve Ballmer's boss today.
Right on. Now, of course, could we ask, like, how's Steve doing? But we won't go down that path. That's not, you can't do that.
I think he's doing quite well.
Let's talk about, you know, people kind of, you know, I hear that a lot, just to kind of segue into that a little bit. And people are like, you know, when you look at the performance of Microsoft over, say, the past 10 years, one could argue that, well, we haven't been doing very, very good. But I would like to know from your perspective, what do you think about when somebody says that? Like, Microsoft hasn't been performing well for the past 10 years. How would you answer that?
First of all, nobody's asked me that yet. So here we go. I think I would say there have been some bumps in the road over the last 10 years. And the thing that I feel really great about is that I think that Microsoft is really, with Bing, with Windows 7, with release 2 of Server 2008. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems to be with hopefully Windows Mobile 7 mm-hmm. coming out next year.
Azure.
I think there are a lot of. It's almost as though the world is sort of everything's happening in sync, in harmony.
Yeah.
the perfect storm.
Yeah. I mean, it really feels like Microsoft is on a roll right now.
Okay.
And you know, obviously, I'm the most recent addition to the board. Mm-hmm. I joined in March 2009. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't have the kind of insight as to what was happening. I mean, I know from the outside what was happening with Microsoft, but, you know, I haven't been sort of on the inside for the last decade.
Sure.
But my sense is, and, you know, just the people I've talked to inside and outside Microsoft is we're in a really good space right now, and it's very exciting. And I even see that with my own students. Mm-hmm. There's a buzz right now about going to work for Microsoft mm-hmm. that I don't think was there a couple of years ago.
Excellent.
So yeah, it's exciting. Mm-hmm. I feel like I arrived just at the right moment.
Right on.
So how does one get tapped to be a member of the Microsoft board? How are you invited, nominated? How does that work?
I know how it worked in my particular situation. And I think it's probably different for different people. Mm-hmm. I think what happens in almost all cases is that the board is looking at its composition, and it decides that there's a particular area of expertise that it would like to expand into. And in my case, they decided that they wanted to have a computer scientist, and preferably an academic computer scientist. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is that obviously, Microsoft, like Google and Apple and lots of other places, are really trying to focus on where, you know, the younger generation is going with technology. Mm. And they wanted to have somebody who is very close to students. And, you know, you might not think that a president of a college would be really close to students, mm-hmm. but if it's Harvey Mudd College, which only has 730 students, mm. where the president lives with the students on the campus, the president's house is right in the middle of the dorms, you know, I really am extremely close to students, and it's why I love being president, why I love being at Mudd, among other things. So I think they were looking for that. I think they were also, because Microsoft is such a technology company, and because Microsoft has, in terms of what its values are, it really values technical expertise. I think they were looking for somebody who would be, you know, who really understood the technology. Now, it's pretty difficult for anyone to understand all the technology areas of Microsoft because it's such a broad company now and doing things on in so many different directions. But I think they felt that getting a computer scientist would be a step in that direction. Absolutely. And so they decided to do that. Then, you know, if you're sort of thinking, who would you ask in Microsoft who might be an appropriate person, you'd probably go to Microsoft Research. And so they did. And Microsoft Research, I've heard, gave them a number of possible names, and I turned out to be at the top of the list, and Bill Gates interviewed me together with Brad Smith. Wow. And that was just a great meeting. It was like, so think about this. You're president of a tiny college that hardly anybody knows anything about. And you're sitting with Mr. Bill Gates. And he's going, so tell me all about Harvard Med College. And what kinds of SAT scores do the students have? Oh, really? And what's your endowment? And what do the students do after they graduate? And, you know, all this kind of stuff. So of our hour-long interview, he spent 45 minutes asking me about Harvard Med College. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going like, oh, yes, this is so great. I'm getting to tell Bill Gates about Harvard Med College. And then at the end of that, he said, well, do you have any questions you want to ask me about being on the board? I guess we should talk about that. And so I asked a couple of questions. And then the next thing after that was, well, first of all, the next thing after that was, it went dead for 3 months. It's not really true, but probably for about 6 weeks, it was the holiday season and so on. But the next thing after that was I got a phone call saying that they would like me to meet the two members of the governance and nominating committee, and those are Ray Gilmartin, who's the lead director for the board, and Jim Cash. And so in February, I went out to Boston to meet with each of them, and that was great. I mean, one of the things I'm just incredibly impressed by is just the quality of people on the board. To a person, they're really smart. That's not surprising. They're also really nice, honest, open, interesting people. I mean, it's just a great group of people. So, and then the next thing after that was that Steve Ballmer came to visit me at Harvey Mudd College because his son Sam was doing a tour of Pomona, just one of the other undergraduate colleges in the Claremont Colleges. Mm. So I'm in my office, which is a little bit smaller than this room, but it also has a whiteboard. Mm. And so Steve fills my office when he comes into it, right? Yeah, he's just full of energy and so on. Sure. And he's talking to me about, you know, the Microsoft strategy, and he's drawing all over my whiteboard. And you know, we talked for about an hour, and then he said, well, I've been authorized by the board to offer you a position on the Microsoft board. And I'm going like, oh, yes, I want to do this. I'm so excited. So the really funny thing is the next day I came into work, and the board had been erased, and I'm going like, I was going to keep it on my board for, like, years and tell people, Steve Ballmer drew that. This is great. You know, it was gone.
So it was a little too efficient.
Yeah. So anyway, that's how I got picked.
Interesting. So I have lots of questions about being on the board, but I want to back up a little bit about you being a computer scientist.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about your experience, your background, your own schooling.
First of all, I'm Canadian. I like most Canadians, I went to my local university. I was living in Edmonton, Alberta, and I went to the University of Alberta, which is about the size of UCLA or UC Berkeley or the University of Washington. It's a large public research institution. I studied honors mathematics, and I have to say, I would sort of put the education up against just about any place, including MUD. The faculty were just amazing. Really, we had very small classes because honors math is a separate program, so we probably had, for the most part, 15 or 20 people in our classes, and the faculty were just enormously dedicated. And then I did my PhD in mathematics as well. Now, I should mention, okay, so this is late 1960s, early 1970s. Mm-hmm. I dropped out of university for almost 2 years in the middle of this. Mm-hmm. And the big reason I did that was I loved mathematics, but I couldn't see how it would make a difference for society. And I really wanted, I think, like many young people, I wanted to do something that I felt would really have an impact on the world. And I loved doing mathematics, but it was sort of like solving puzzles, and it was hard to see how that really made a difference. But during the time I was away from university, I just couldn't stop doing mathematics, and I realized, okay, this is an addiction. Mm-hmm. I just need to accept the fact that I need to do mathematics. This is real. And came back, did my PhD, expected, both of my parents were university professors. I expected, you know, to get a job as an assistant professor in a Canadian university. And I got finished my PhD in 1977, and it was a horrible time for finding jobs, particularly in Canada. There were like two jobs available as assistant professors in Canada. I applied to 83 different universities. Most of them are places you've never heard of in the United States. And I got a tenure-track position at one of them. It's called Oakland University. It's in Michigan, about 25 miles north of Detroit. And I went there, and I hated it. Mm-hmm. And it was much more about sort of social things than anything else. I was single. I had one date my entire year there, and it was with somebody I didn't like, but that's how desperate I was. There were no foreign movies, no ethnic restaurants, no bookstores, I just was awful. Mm-hmm. And so I was bemoaning this while I was at a conference, and somebody said, somebody who I actually knew as a mathematician said something about, you know, there are lots of jobs in computer science. And I went, like, I don't know any computer science. Well, you could do a second PhD in computer science. Oh, yeah, I could do that. And they told me about this guy, Andy Yao, who had done his PhD in theoretical physics, another field in which there are no jobs. And, you know, he'd done his PhD with a Nobel laureate and his postdoc with a Nobel laureate and, you know, could see that he was going to do another 10 years of postdocs before he could possibly get a job. And he went to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign mm-hmm. for 2 years, did a PhD in computer science there, and he has had a spectacular career. He's won the Turing Award. He's currently in China, really helping to develop first-rate theoretical computer science graduate programs there. And he has been a friend of mine for 30 years, but this is 2 years before that, or a year before that. And so I said, fine, I'll go do a PhD in computer science. And so the person who was giving me advice said, I said, okay, where would the three best places to go do this? And he said, MIT, Stanford, and the University of Toronto. Because at that time, they were the best places in theoretical computer science. So, and he gave me a name to phone at each place. So I called the guy at MIT, and he says, oh, you sound like you'd be great, but we already have 11 theory students, and we only have funding for 5.5. So we probably couldn't fund you. And I called the guy at Stanford, and he said, oh, our application's closed 2 months ago, so you'd have to wait a year. And I called the guy at Toronto, and, of course, I'm Canadian. They go, you're Canadian? Oh, do we ever want you? So I went to Toronto, and I started. I took 5 graduate courses in each semester without any of the undergraduate prerequisites. So this was hard work. It's probably the hardest I've ever worked in my life. I mean, I just did nothing but study. And by the time I got into the beginning of the second semester, I was getting requests to apply for jobs from computer science departments. Mm-hmm. And I came back from a job interview, and there was a message waiting for me from my roommate saying, the head of the computer science department at Toronto called, and you are to call right away. So I call, and I'm going like, oh, my goodness, maybe I'm in trouble.
Trouble, what I do?
And he goes, we have jobs at our department. There better be an application on my desk by 9 a.m. Monday morning. So
you were in demand.
I was in demand. And so I started as an assistant professor in computer science a year after I'd arrived to do my second PhD. I never finished my second PhD. And shortly after that, and while I was working as a professor, we had a guest speaker in a seminar that I was running from IBM Research, a guy called Nick Pippinger. And 6 weeks after he visited, we got engaged. So this was one of these, you know, we just met, and he was 32 and I was 28. And, you know, within 48 hours, we were having conversations like, well, what kind of person would you want to marry? And how many kids would you want to have? And where would you want to live? And all of those kinds of things.
Awesome.
And so he was working at T.J. Watson in New York. And obviously one of us was going to have to move if we wanted to live in the same place. So Toronto had been trying to hire him, actually, for a long time. So they were thrilled. They made him an offer, a faculty position. IBM Research really didn't want to lose him, so they made me an offer. And MIT, figuring that, you know, they... So Nick did his PhD and also bachelor and master's at MIT, tried to recruit the two of us, but we ended up with my going to IBM Research because Nick is very shy. And I thought, boy, getting married and having kids, this is probably going to be a big change in his life. Maybe it would be better if we didn't change his work at the same time. But we, in fact, we ended up going to be two members of a group that was starting up in IBM San Jose Research, and went there and spent 8 years, and we actually had both of our kids were born while we were there. And so that's how I got into computer science.
So, but it was because you wanted a job.
It was because I wanted a job.
It wasn't necessarily a passion of yours. It wasn't something that you had always been interested in.
I'd never thought about it. I mean, I was passionate about mathematics. I knew that, I mean, I didn't know when I was doing my PhD. It wasn't until I actually met a mathematician whose work I knew and found out that he was actually in the Stanford Computer Science Department that I realized that mathematicians could work in computer science. And so, yeah, I mean, it was really, I did it because I could see that the career opportunities in mathematics were going to be really limited. Now, you know, in retrospect, I've been very successful as a mathematician, and so I didn't really have to, you know, it's clear that I would have managed to get a job as a mathematician if I had been a little bit more patient. But I'm thrilled that I went and learned computer science because it's enabled me to do all kinds of things I would never have been able to do if I'd only stayed a mathematician. So I've spent my career doing mathematics, but also doing things that are not just theoretical computer science, but also other areas of computer science. I've done a lot of work in interactive multimedia, particularly for math education for kids. Done some work in assistive technologies. And, I mean, I feel like having learned computer science opened this incredible world to me in terms of ability to explore ways of making a change in the world that just never would have been there if I'd only done mathematics. So I just lucked out. Mm-hmm. So what I often tell people when I'm sort of talking to them about how they choose their careers is, it is important to know what you like, but it's also important to know what the world needs right now. Mm-hmm. Because you can often find, and that's of course what happened to me, the world really needed computer scientists at that point. I mean, it was just, because the field was growing so fast, there were very few faculty who could teach computer science. And so that was what the world really needed. They didn't need yet another pure mathematician.
Right.
And by being willing to learn, I mean, this was sort of like the way I did computer science is sort of like the way you would learn a foreign language by just being dumped into the foreign country and then just having to sort it out. Well, that was what it was like learning computer science. But that's actually a great way to learn it. You know, I mean, it's sort of, and as my first year, it was very hard and I hated it. I mean, I just have to say I was not enjoying learning computer science. And it's hard to enjoy when you're working that hard and everything is so new and so on. But by the time I'd been in the field for a couple of years, I was able to say, oh, wow, this is amazing. I'm just very lucky to be in a field in its very early days and to be able to, you know, participate in the growth and the direction of this field.
Mm-hmm.
So one question that I would ask, because we do a lot of stuff on Channel 9, you know, we're fortunate at Microsoft to have language designers like Eric Meyer and other people such as this, and it seems that if you look at computer science over the past 30 years, I mean, it's not that old of a discipline.
Right.
It doesn't seem to have those same kind of things that, like, the discoveries in mathematics, the discoveries in physics, the discoveries in chemistry. it seems like it hasn't changed that much as a scientific discipline for over that extent of time. And I would ask you, you know, A, is that true? And B, do you see, I mean, do we still need more computer scientists? It seems like we do. We need to push this stuff further out into the galaxy.
So I guess the first thing I would say is that I see huge changes in computer science over that period of time. So one ongoing thing that I see happening is that, you know, back 30 years ago, computer science was, it was much narrower. And part of that is, you know, just remember how, you know, we didn't have color screens on displays, right?
Sure.
We didn't have all points addressable printers. We didn't, for the most part, you know, I still learned on punch cards. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's hard to believe, but I mean, I'm just was at the very last end of the punch card era. And just the power of the computers we're working with are probably less than what's in my wristwatch today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just amazing. And so one of the things that has happened over the last 30 years is as we have seen technology, computer technology, entering basically every sphere of our life, the things you need to do in computer science have become much, much broader. So, for instance, human-computer interaction. That there were people doing human-computer interaction 30 years ago, but it, you know, it wasn't. There were a few courses that you would take as an undergraduate or a graduate student. It wasn't at the core of computer science. Well, I would argue today we really know that that is incredibly important. And the way that you design something has a huge impact on how it actually gets used and whether it's effective and all those kinds of things. Just about you look at machine learning, which is, I think, really transforming many of the ways that we use and understand data. That wasn't around 30 years ago. You know, that's roughly, you know, that's approximately 10 years old in the sense of, I mean, it's more than 10 years old in terms of the key ideas behind it, much more than 10 years old. But if you really look at the applications starting to have impact over the last 3 or 4 years, the techniques that are going into that are really the kind of work that's been doing. There's just been a huge shift over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree that we don't see... you know, we don't see a Newton or a Leibniz the way you would in mathematics. But I think a lot of that is partly because of computer science is being developed at a time when we have a lot of mathematics and physics and engineering and so on that you're building on top of.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also because we're really at the early stages of what's going to change.
Yes.
And so I mentioned that I've spent a lot of time on interactive multimedia. And there's a former Microsoft employee, Ben Slivka, who's doing a startup called Dreambox Learning, and which is a math activities, and it's currently kindergarten through grade 2, but they're planning on, you know, pushing it up much higher. And just watching what Ben is doing with that, it's, so what's really interesting about this is they have about 40,000 students already using it. And one of the things his company has done is created some programming language called LessonScript that the teachers can use, not the teachers in the classroom, but they basically hired the people who develop the activities are teachers for mm-hmm. that age range.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was a programming language created so that they really could work with mm-hmm. it and develop activities, it's, you know, they're the people that should be thinking about the activities. Because they've got 40,000 students who are using these activities, they can actually track. So, you know, they have basically a directed graph that says, you know, if you've completed activities 1 through 5, you should be able to do 6 now. Well, they can track that. You know, okay, half of the students who've done 1 through 5 actually can't do 6. So we need a 5.5.
Mm-hmm.
They've got the feedback loop happening in real time. And that's, you know, I look at this and designing effective educational software is extremely challenging. And one of the reasons is, or has been, that, you know, you create something you think that works, you put it out in the classroom, you test it, you find out there are all these shortcuts that students can use to get past, you know, what they're supposed to be learning, so you come and you change it, and you iterate 5 or 6 or 7 times before you get something right. Well, they've got that feedback loop actually, you know, it's happening on a daily basis. And so, you know, for me, that's exactly what needs to happen in the future, and I think we really will, we're finally at the point where we'll start to see some of the level of progress in educational software that all the hype said would happen 30 years ago. Well, 30 years later, I think the technology has caught up to the point that it's actually feasible.
Excellent.
So I'm wondering, and this may be anecdotal, but your students at MUD, what is the discussion today about what the world needs?
Oh, this is, yeah. So first of all, students at MUD, they're all science and engineering majors, right? Mm-hmm. So they're already focused on sort of technology areas. And I think the first thing we would say is we need interdisciplinary teams. Mm-hmm. And we need teams of people who understand not just whatever the technologies or the science or the engineering is. We need people who can actually work, who understand economic realities, cultural differences, policy issues, privacy issues, all of which have some pieces of technology and have some pieces of other areas. And so one of the things that we feel very strongly, and the students who choose to come to MUD are coming for this reason, is we think that it's not enough just to learn computer science. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're going to be a computer scientist. Because computer science is now going to impact every part of the world, from healthcare to entertainment mm-hmm. to voting to whatever, mm-hmm. they need to learn, they really need to learn right across science and engineering. So every single one of our students, no matter what they're majoring in, they take a core that covers engineering, physics, math, computer science, biology, chemistry. But they also take a third of roughly between 30% and a third of their credits in humanities, social sciences, and the arts. Mm-hmm. Because we think that that's just as important. Mm-hmm. So when our students, you know, one of the things I really, I believe very strongly is that the world of science and engineering, including computer science, needs to focus more of its attention on the challenges that are really facing the world. So what are those? Well, obviously, healthcare, literacy, the environment, energy. You know, these are really big challenges. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have a culture of science and engineering where our best and our brightest are going to be motivated to actually work on those things and have the kinds of education that empower them to work on it, we are going to be in a big mess. Mm-hmm. I think it would be fair to say we are in a big mm-hmm. mess. And so I think it's just really important that we educate young people who are empowered to say, yeah, I understand that it takes, you know, that these are big problems and it's going to take a long time, but I want to have the skills so that I can be part of a team that actually works effectively on them.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So in those classes, and when you're teaching them calculus, for example, are you also teaching them the history of mathematics and sort of the biography of Newton?
So let me give you an example of a course that's going on right now. So we've just done this revision to our core curriculum, which is part of, we're in sort of a transformation of the college. The college is just over 50 years old, and it's been amazingly successful for being 50 years old. But we know that the world around us is changing, and we need to be able to change to accommodate that as well. And so one of the things we're really emphasizing is writing, because we believe that communication skills are, if you don't have communication skills, your ability to make a difference is going to be limited. And so one of the courses that's being taught as one of our new pilot writing courses is being taught by a math professor. And it's being taught around a book, which is called How Mathematicians Think. And so they're doing a ton of writing, and it's about writing about any aspect, various aspects of mathematics. And the same math professor, his name's Mike Orison, and, you know, I totally love him, but, you know, the truth is I love pretty much every professor. But so in my first couple of years at MUD, I was having lunches with small groups of faculty and asked them about what they loved about MUD and what they would change and so on. And he was saying that when he first arrived at MUD, he thought what he really wanted to get out of every course he taught was that every student would find a piece of mathematics that they could embrace and really sort of be meaningful to them. And then he said after a couple of years, he realized that really wasn't enough. And so what he wanted was not only that, but that every student would learn something about themselves as a human being during the class. And so, for example, not this last summer, the summer before, he was teaching a summer course on linear algebra. And a couple of classes before the end of the just before the end of the course, he asked students to write an essay about what they had learned about themselves in this course about linear algebra. And they were he said they were absolutely amazing. The thing that probably most students chose was change of basis and what that said about perspective. Because the whole idea was all of a sudden they realized that they were carrying a particular set of axes with them about how they saw their life. Mm-hmm. And that when they changed those axes, they would be able to perceive things differently. And so this is the thing about MUD, is it's not just about learning about vector spaces and, you know, all those kinds of things and linear algebra. It's about thinking about how what you learn in that makes you think about yourself in relationship to the world. And it's sort of, I mean, so there's a kind of reflection that goes on in the learning that's pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Mm-hmm. So you're basically generating a lot of critical thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, to me, I mean, that's awesome. So Harvey Mudd, we've always known it's a great
mm-hmm.
school. I mean,
yeah.
Most people can't get into Harvey Mudd. That's awesome. Really cool.
So at least one other thing that I wanted to call out that's on your resume was post-IBM was that you were the Dean of Engineering at Princeton?
Yep.
Tell us about that.
That was very interesting. I sometimes say I was released early for good behavior. No, it was an amazing opportunity. So before I went to Princeton and after IBM Research, in between I was at the University of British Columbia for 15 years. And, you know, Vancouver is one of my favorite, it is my favorite city in the universe, closely followed by Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very similar cities. And but one of the things I realized is if you want to change the world, you can't change it from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
At least if you want to change the world of science and engineering, you can't change it from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is that the Center for Science and Engineering is the United States. That's the dominant country. I had come to this conclusion. I'd been there 14 years, and I totally loved it. And both of our kids, of course, really grew up in Canada, and that's a great. It's also, you know, has great schools and it's a great place for kids to grow up. But I realized that, you know, sooner or later I was going to have to return to the U.S. That there was just no option. And when Princeton, started expressing interest in recruiting me for the Dean of Engineering position, what really excited me about it was that they were really looking for change. Princeton is exactly the kind of place where if you create change, people will pay attention, because it's an institution that places copy. And the kinds of change that we're looking for were very consistent with what I said about, wanting to focus the attention of science and engineering on major problems facing the world. And they also, they had a new president, Shirley Tilghman, also Canadian. And so when she recruited me, it was really to come and be a change agent for the engineering school. And the thing about the thing about places like Harvey Mudd College and Princeton is because, and Microsoft for that matter, because they're very successful institutions, it's very hard to create change. Because when you're a successful institution, you never really know exactly what is contributing to that success. And when you think about changing things, there's this worry that you will damage whatever the basis for that success is. But when I arrived, I hired two associate deans who were faculty members, and we basically, with a couple of other people, worked on a strategic planning process that would really engage every faculty member in the engineering school, lots of faculty from the rest of the university, alumni, students, staff, that just we wanted to make it a very inclusive strategic planning process. And we ran 11 one-day workshops on topics that were important to the engineering school. And four of them were things that were sort of not related to research themes, so one on the undergraduate experience, and one on the graduate experience, one on faculty, and one on collaborations with other institutions. But seven were on research themes that cut across the school. So things like one was engineering and the arts, another one was energy and environment, another one was IT and systems, and so on and so forth. And the really interesting thing is that over 90% of the faculty attended one of these workshops. We asked them to attend two, and on average they attended three. Mm-hmm. And the plan that came out of this, which was which we launched about a year and a half after I had joined Princeton, which is called Engineering for a Better World, so you get it, that it fits with mm-hmm. the overall idea. It ended up being embraced by the entire engineering school and the university. And it was sort of one of these things that, I mean, I often joke that I've never been part of so much change in 3.5 years as the 3.5 years I was at Princeton. Though now that I've been at Mudd for almost 3.5 years, the rate of change is pretty similar. Probably because we used the same strategic planning process at Mudd in my first 6 months there. Mm. But it became clear that when I was approached by Mudd, and I had no intention of leaving Princeton, I mean, things were going really well, I really liked it there. I'm not crazy about living in New Jersey, I like the West Coast a lot better, but other than that, things were going really well. But what became clear to me was that by the time I had been there about 3 years, it became clear that Princeton didn't really need me anymore. They'd embraced the change. They had several internal leaders who would make good deans of engineering, and that they were, on track to fundraise for all the things that needed to happen, and that they had really embraced the new direction, and I didn't need to be there. Whereas Mudd was just sort of it was at the beginning of it hadn't made that transition yet, and it was very interesting because I think. Princeton found it very hard to believe that I would actually choose to leave them to go to a place like Mudd. They expected me to go be president of Yale or Michigan or something. But my position was, large research universities, they're great, but research is not where change is needed in this country. Change is needed in education. I mean, we are desperately in need of significant change, particularly with respect to math and science and engineering education, from K, really from K through 12 up through the undergraduate level. And no major research university is going to take on the leadership of that, because their focus is primarily research.
Right.
And if anyone was ever going to do that, it's hard to imagine a better place than Harvey Mudd College.
Mm.
So, when I chose to go there, it was really about saying, okay, we've done something great is happening at Princeton. I'm incredibly proud of it. I think the dean who replaced me, Vince Poor, is fabulous. It's just, they are just sailing along at full speed, and it's great. What I realize about Mudd is I'm not going to be able to leave Mudd anytime soon because it's just a much bigger transition. I really need the world to know about Mudd, and that takes time. The world knows about Princeton.
Right.
All we had to do there was sort of put the engineering school on a leadership direction where they would really do something impressive. mud, we have to convince the world that there actually is this place and that it's important to the world and it's exciting to be involved with it and all those kinds of things.
But I mean, Harvey Mudd is a college that when you hear that, when you hear it, you're like, wow. I mean, that's, in my opinion, it's like hearing, I graduated from MIT. Wow, that's impressive. I graduated from Harvey Mudd. Wow, that's impressive.
Right, but you were at Microsoft.
Well, I haven't always been at Microsoft, but...
Not everyone knows about Harvey Mudd like they know about Princeton.
But let me ask you this, though, but this is why the question that I really want to ask. I went to a small school as well, with the whole kind of critical thinking and can study math and also learn that Isaac Newton was an alchemist, which is really interesting. What I would ask you is, can that model scale? So the big giant research universities are the ones where the majority of students who want to go to college because, A, they can afford it, B, it's in their state, C, you don't have to get 1,400 on your SATs and be a super stellar academic.
Thousands of students go.
Exactly.
Like 700. Right.
So,
right,
but what you're doing in Harvey Mudd and other colleges that people have gone to that are small and academic and make you actually think about things, how does that scale?
So that's a great question. And I mean, you need to remember that I spent 15 years of my life at a large research institution, the University of British Columbia, and I was educated at a similar place, the University of Alberta, and that both of my kids went to large public research institutions. Our son Yannick went to UBC, and Sasha just graduated from Berkeley a year ago. So, and as Sasha would say, didn't you always tell us that large public research institutions were better than anything else? And I would go, yes. So here's what you can do at Mudd that is important to those that kind of education. Because Mudd is so small and because it is 100% dedicated to the education of its students, it is also an incubator for innovation. And in undergraduate science, engineering, and math education, as well as, frankly, in humanities and social sciences and the arts. And because of that, we can do things that we can experiment with things, and partly because our students, you know, have 1,400 and something on their SATs, our students are, fault-tolerant guinea pigs, let me put it that way. You know, we don't say that, and we don't mean that either. But you can do things, try different approaches with students of the caliber we've got that you probably might not want to do in large classes. Mm. What I know about large research universities is that they, too, are capable of taking innovations that have probably been pioneered someplace else. Sometimes they are the place that does the innovation, but usually because of the size, they can't do something that really affects all students. We can do something. So, for example, one of the areas, I believe that because of the impact of energy and because of what's happening with climate change and energy in the environment, we actually need every student that majors in sciences and engineering, and probably that majors in anything, should know something about energy and the environment. I'm not saying every student should major in it, but for instance, chemistry courses should be green chemistry courses. They should be thinking about issues. Even in computer science courses, we need to think about the amount of energy that gets used in a data center. And, you know, I mean, these are... Mm-hmm. It's just important to have this kind of awareness. Well, who's going to put together that kind of curriculum? That would be us. Mm-hmm. And if we do put together that kind of curriculum and share it broadly with the rest of the world, there will be, you know, faculty members at Berkeley and at UCLA and at University of Washington and so on that pick up pieces of that and, you know, innovate on that and, you know, make new contributions and so on. But we can be this little incubation for innovation place in terms of education, and we can have a much, much bigger impact than just those 700 students. Now, those 700 students and our 5,500 alumni, yeah, they have a big impact on the world. But I think that we've got this role about what we do for our own students, but then I think this other role that is probably even more important, or at least equally important, is somebody really needs to help reform education in science, engineering, and mathematics. It needs to be more interdisciplinary. It needs to have more writing. whether it's being taught at Berkeley or being taught at Mudge, these things are true. Mm-hmm. And we can be the place that demonstrates it's possible. So where'd you go to school?
I went to school at the Evergreen State College.
Okay.
Here in Washington.
I've heard of it. I even know a student who's attending there.
Excellent. I mean, the people kind of joke about it because it has a history of kind of, being kind of a... It was formed in the 60s, late 60s.
Yeah, yeah. I understand.
Hippies. Radical
hippie.
School.
Yeah.
Well, it was a hippie school. I mean, and, you know, but the thing that's really amazing about the school is that it encourages people who are self-directed, self-motivated to build their own program of education, and you have a full-time professor that actually will help you. So you do all the direct. So I studied math and sort of planetary science, and I was able to construct my own program about stuff that I was really passionate about, like how life forms on the surface of a planetary body, right? That's what I wanted to understand as. And when you're young, that's a sort of more interesting point here, is that the problem that I see with these big giant universities is that people are, in my opinion, you're smartest when you're young. And so when you're in your 20s, when I was in my 20s, I didn't know that what I was thinking and dreaming up about these big problems was actually, I could fail in trying to understand them.
Right.
So we need to encourage, that's where the next Einstein is going to come from computer science. It's not going to be a gray-haired person in Microsoft Research. In my opinion, their ability to do the things that you need to do when you're younger is gone. Not that they're not brilliant, but where are those young people? If they're going to Brand X University sitting in a class with 500 students, who knows if you're ever going to light that spark? So that, to me, is a really interesting problem.
Well, you know, it's just interesting because, you know, my daughter, who I said graduated from Berkeley, and, you know, I think pretty much all of her classes had 300-plus people in them. On the other hand, she really knew what she wanted. And so the reason she wanted to be at a large university was she wanted access to all the resources and all of the research programs that would be there. Mm. And so, you know, she wants to save the world. This is not surprising.
Good.
The way she wants to save the world is through, she's all about Africa and developing nations. And right now she's in Pakistan working for the International Rescue Committee. Doing human rights advocacy for refugees. So, you know, I mean, so she did peace and conflict studies at Berkeley, which is the, it's their program for international relations. And she wanted to be there because she wanted to have the wealth of resources and different kinds of courses and so on. So, you know, I think she got, for her, that was the right education. Mm-hmm. For her son, he's a math computer science geek, just like both of his parents. And, you know, I think it's very interesting. He and his friends took over the math club at UBC. Hmm. So they ended up having this, you know, very intimate experience among themselves. They're all very bright kids. It wasn't so much about math as about video games, I think, for the most part. But... you know, I think he got a great education there too. So, I wish every student who wanted the MUD experience could get the MUD experience, and that probably doesn't scale. But if you can find out what really helps people succeed and share that with others, I think, you know, I think it's possible to get a great education in many different kinds of places. Mm. But I think you have opportunities to do some things at these very small colleges that are hard to try
in the big
in large places.
Certainly.
So I'm panicking because we're running out of time and we haven't asked you the key question yet, this being the Women in Technology series. So you've had a stellar career. Sounds like you've had all these opportunities that kind of fell into your lap. I don't even know if you sought them out, but what was it like being a female in this industry?
Right.
Meaning, I assume that you were the minority in all of your classes and in terms of being a female.
So for the last 20 years, I've been the first female in my job.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I've been hired, I think, because they were interested in having the first female on that job. And sometimes I've been hired with being female being real disadvantage because they didn't want to hire the first female in that job. When I think about why I've been successful, I think in the early stages of my career, quite frankly, I was successful because I had a very male-type personality. It's very aggressive, very argumentative, very obnoxious. I'm embarrassed that that's who I was, and at some level inside myself still am. I grew up being proud of being very boy-like. And, you know, like, if there was something girls didn't do, I did it, for sure. So I played the trumpet. I was the best student in my math class, even though I was the only girl in the advanced, you know, grade 12 math class and all that kind of stuff. So I'd say for the first, you know, probably 10 years of my career, it really helped that I had, you know, you really have to be louder and obnoxious in order to be recognized and to survive. And there's somebody in Microsoft Research who's a very close friend of mine, Jennifer Chase, and we have very similar personalities. And what's really interesting, and I sometimes refer to us as sisters. I'm 5 years older, so I'm the older sister. But we're both mathematicians and computer scientists. We have both fought very hard to be listened to and to, you know, like not to be, I mean, because you sort of have to. So then once you start to move up in your career, that obnoxious personality is a detriment because it's very interesting that being, you know, that once you sort of become a manager and then a senior manager and, you know, sort of move up on these things, there's a lot less tolerance for women being aggressive. Mm. And so I've spent, you know, the last at least 15 years of my career, actually more like 20 years of my career, trying to tone that down a bit and trying to be quieter, less argumentative, stopping saying, "That's the stupidest thing I ever heard." That's my first response to something. In the way that, I mean, I learn by arguing. I mean, that's really, if when somebody presents something and if I don't understand it, I want to ask a whole bunch of questions about it. And I get, I'm not deliberately emotional, but I do get emotional. I mean, it's part of just my way of interacting with it. And so I've had to really tone that down. So
specifically because you're a female?
I think so.
Are you saying there's a double standard?
Absolutely.
That kind of behavior would be rewarded by a...
Absolutely. Especially in, I would say, especially in sort of technology areas, that males get away with being much more aggressive than females do. But on the other hand, you know, when I look at this, and I think I'm most successful when I'm not aggressive like that. Mm. I actually think that I'm a better leader when I'm a better listener. Mm-hmm. And when I don't intimidate people by arguing vociferously with them. Mm-hmm. It's really not necessary to argue vociferously. I may enjoy doing it. Mm-hmm. It may be the easiest behavior response for me, but it's not the most effective, mm-hmm. I would say, whether it's males or females.
Mm-hmm. Because you leave awake.
Yeah, you destroy people. You just really don't need to do that.
Right.
So I it's interesting. When you're the first female in a job, people attribute all kinds of things to you because you're female. Mm-hmm. And you're different from whoever the person was before in a whole bunch of ways. And I'm often, I think most of the time, I tend to be the sort of the new management wave in terms of, you know, bringing a different style. So, for example, I'm all about teams, right? You know, I have five vice presidents and six vice presidents at MUD and the director of the president's office, and we make a team called the cabinet, and we do everything together. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just we make every major decision about the college as a group, and it's a fabulous group of people, the best team I've ever had, and I love working with them. But the former president worked one-on-one with each vice president, so the hub-and-spoke model. And that's a big change. I mean, I didn't even realize the change I was bringing in. And similarly, we did the same kind of change in the engineering school at Princeton, where the department chairs became, together with the associate deans, became that leadership team. And so I'm usually the person who's bringing a new management approach to management. And, you know, as I'm getting older and more experienced and, you know, hopefully wiser, I'm beginning to realize that that's almost as much of a change as being the first female in the job. Mm. And I'm realizing that I should be more intentional about how I do things rather than just coming in and going, plunk, here's the new universe for all of us. Mm-hmm. It would be better to be a little bit gentler about how I do these things. So I think for me, the bit about being the first woman is the only way I think I've really survived is I sort of arrive in a position, I screw up royally in the first period of time, and might be a year and a half. And it's not all my own fault that I'm screwing up. Part of it is because I am so different from the person that's been there before. Then I understand that I've screwed up royally, and I make a very significant effort, and this is the very painful part, to change the way I'm doing things so it's going to be more effective. And then because I've changed, people embrace that and laud me as being very successful. Mm. But it's really because I've been able to listen and make some changes. Mm-hmm. And I think that women, to a large extent, especially in academia, which is, I think, is actually a much tougher place than industry for leadership, because you don't have top-down authority. You only have influence. I think that the women that I see being successful, it's one way or another, have to make those kinds of adjustments.
Hmm. Interesting.
So what's the, at Harvey Mudd College, I mean, what is the gender ratio?
We're about 36% female.
Wow.
At both the student and the faculty level. Mm-hmm. So we've been close to 40%. Well, we were, the last 3 years, we were 42%, then 40%, and this year, unfortunately, 36% in our entering student body. So I'm sure we'll be back up to 40% next year. It's what's impressive is at the faculty level that we have so many women. Mm. You know, if you look at most of our competitors, they're around 15%. And the reason we're so successful in recruiting women at the faculty level is there is no other place in the country where you can both teach the kind of students we have at Mudd and have your teaching valued as seriously or even more seriously than your research. Mm. And so, I mean, our faculty do research. They win NSF Career Awards and, you know, all kinds of things like that. But we take curriculum development and teaching extraordinarily seriously, and that seems to appeal to female faculty. So.
Interesting.
Interesting.
Very cool.
I am afraid that we're out of time, but I have to ask one last question.
Good.
What is the thing about being a member of the Microsoft board that has surprised you the most, that you did not expect or predict?
The learning. I mean, it's just like, it's like being back trying to do that second PhD in computer science. You're being dropped into this enormously complicated, fascinating organization. Mm-hmm. And there's so much to learn, and it's great. So, yeah, I'm having a ball.
That's great.
Now, just one thing. How many women are on the board?
There are two right now. Dina Dublon has been on for 4 years, and she's already a good friend.
You weren't the first.
I don't mind not being the first. It's nice being the second.
Cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
That's great. Well, thank you so
Amazing.
Much for your time. I really appreciate it. This was fascinating.
Oh, it was lots of fun. Thank
cool.
you.
Thank you. Good luck on the board.
Thank you.
Cool.